"May I ask where you have been at this extraordinary hour?" said Grandcourt.
"Oh, yes, I have been to Miss Lapidoth's, to ask her to come and sing for us," said Gwendolen, laying her gloves on the little table beside her and looking down at them.
"And to ask her about her relations with Deronda," said Grandcourt, with the coldest possible sneer in his low voice, which in poor Gwendolen's ear was diabolical. For the first time since their marriage she flashed out upon him without inward check. Turning her eyes full on his, she said in a biting tone,
"Yes, and what you said is false, a low, wicked falsehood."
"She told you so, did she?" returned Grandcourt with a more thoroughly distilled sneer. Gwendolen was mute. The daring anger within her was turned into the rage of dumbness. What reasons for her belief could she give? All the reasons that seemed so strong and living within her, she saw them suffocated and shriveled up under her husband's breath. There was no proof to give, but her own impression, which would seem to him her own folly. She turned her head quickly away from him and looked angrily toward the end of the room. She would have risen, but he was in her way. Grandcourt saw his advantage.
"It's of no consequence so far as her singing goes," he said in his superficial drawl. "You can have her to sing if you like." Then after a pause he added in his lowest imperious tone, "But you will please to observe that you are not to go near that house again. As my wife you must take my word about what is proper for you. When you undertook to be Mrs. Grandcourt, you undertook not to make a fool of yourself. You have been making a fool of yourself this morning, and if you were to go on as you have begun, you might soon get yourself talked of at the clubs in a way you would not like. What do you know about the world? You have married me, and must be guided by my opinion."
Every slow sentence of that speech had a terrific mastery in it for Gwendolen's nature. If the low tones had come from a physician telling her that her symptoms were those of a fatal disease, and prognosticating its course, she could not have been more helpless against the argument that lay in it. But she was permitted to move now, and her husband never again made any reference to what had occurred this morning. He knew the force of his own words. If this white-handed man with a perpendicular profile had been sent to govern a difficult colony, he might have won reputation among his contemporaries. He had certainly ability, would have understood that it was safer to exterminate than to cajole superseded proprietors, and would not have flinched from making things safe in that way. Gwendolen did not, for all this, part with her recovered faith. Rather, she kept it with a more anxious tenacity, as a Protestant of old kept his Bible hidden, or a Catholic his crucifix, according to the side favored by the civil arm. And it was characteristic of her that, apart from the impression gained concerning Deronda in that visit, her imagination was little occupied with Mirah or the eulogized brother. The one result established for her was that Deronda had acted simply as a generous benefactor, and the phrase "reading Hebrew" had fleeted unimpressively across her sense of hearing, as a stray stork might have made its peculiar flight across her landscape without rousing any surprised reflection on its natural history. But the issue of that visit, as it regarded her husband, took a strongly active part in the process which made an habitual conflict within her, and was the cause of some external change, perhaps not observed by anyone except Deronda. As the weeks went on, bringing occasional transient interviews with her, he thought that he perceived in her an intensifying of her superficial hardness and resolute display, which made her abrupt betrayals of agitation the more marked and disturbing to him. In fact, she was undergoing a sort of discipline for the refractory which, as soon as possible, like conversion, bends half the self with a terrible strain and exasperates the unwillingness of the other half. Grandcourt had an active divination rather than discernment of refractoriness in her, and what had happened about Mirah quickened his suspicion that there was an increase of it dependent on the occasions when she happened to see Deronda. There was some confounded nonsense between them. He did not imagine it exactly as flirtation, and his imagination in other branches was rather restricted.
But it was nonsense that evidently kept up a kind of simmering in her mind, an inward action which might become disagreeable outward.
Husbands in the old time are known to have suffered from a threatening devoutness in their wives, presenting itself first indistinctly as oddity, and ending in that mild form of lunatic asylum, a nunnery. Grandcourt had a vague perception of threatening moods in Gwendolen, which the unity between them in his views of marriage required him peremptorily to check. Among the means he chose, one was peculiar, and was less ably calculated than the speeches we have just heard. He determined that she should know the main purport of the will he was making, but he could not communicate this himself, because it involved the fact of his relation to Mrs. Glasher and her children, and that there should be any overt recognition of this between Gwendolen and himself was supremely repugnant to him. Like all proud, closely wrapped natures, he shrank from explicitness and detail, even on trivialities, if they were personal. A valet must maintain a strict reserve with him on the subject of shoes and stockings, and clashing was intolerable to him. His habitual want was to put collision out of the question by the quiet, massive pressure of his rule. But he wished Gwendolen to know that before he made her an offer, it was no secret to him that she was aware of his relations with Lydia, her previous knowledge being the apology for bringing the subject before her now. Some men in his place might have thought of writing what he wanted her to know in the form of a letter, but Grandcourt hated writing. Even writing a note was a bore to him, and he had long been accustomed to have all his writing done by Lush. We know that there are persons who will forego their own obvious interest rather than do anything so disagreeable as to write letters, and it is not probable that these imperfect utilitarians would rush into manuscript and syntax on a difficult subject in order to save another's feelings. To Grandcourt it did not even occur that he would or could write to Gwendolen the information in question. And the only medium of communication he could use was Lush, who to his mind was as much of an implement as pen and paper. But here too Grandcourt had his reserves, and would not have uttered a word likely to encourage Lush in an impudent sympathy with any supposed grievance in a marriage which had been discommended by him. Who that has a confidant escapes believing too little in his penetration, and too much in his discretion? Grandcourt had always allowed Lush to know his external affairs indiscriminately, irregularities, debts, want of ready money. He had only used discrimination about what he would allow his confidant to say to him, and he had been so accustomed to this human tool that the having him at call in London was a recovery of lost ease. It followed that Lush knew all the provisions of the will more exactly than they were known to the testator himself. Grandcourt did not doubt that Gwendolen, since she was a woman who could put two and two together, knew or suspected Lush to be the contriver of her interview with Lydia, and that this was the reason why her first request was for his banishment. But the bent of a woman's inferences on mixed subjects, which excites mixed passions, is not determined by her capacity for simple addition. And here Grandcourt lacked the only organ of thinking that could have saved him from mistake, namely some experience of the mixed passions concerned. He had correctly divined one half of Gwendolen's dread. All that related to her personal pride and her perception that his will must conquer hers. But the remorseful half, even if he had known of her broken promise, was as much out of his imagination as the other side of the moon. What he believed her to feel about Lydia was solely a tongue-tied jealousy, and what he believed Lydia to have written with the jewels was the fact that she had once been used to wearing them, with other amenities such as he imputed to the intercourse with jealous women. He had the triumphant certainty that he could aggravate the jealousy and yet smite it with a more absolute dumbness. His object was to engage all his wife's egoism on the same side as his own, and in his employment of Lush he did not intend to insult her. She ought to understand that he was the only possible envoy. Grandcourt's view of things was considerably fenced in by his general sense that what suited him, others must put up with. There is no escaping the fact that want of sympathy condemns us to corresponding stupidity. Mephistopheles, thrown upon real life and obliged to manage his own plots, would inevitably make blunders. One morning he went to Gwendolen in the boudoir beyond the back drawing-room, hat and gloves in hand, and said in his best-tempered, most persuasive drawl, standing before her and looking down on her as she sat with a book in her lap,
Gwendolen, there's some business about property to be explained. I have told Lush to come and explain it to you. He knows all about these things. I am going out. He can come up now. He's the only person who can explain. I suppose you'll not mind."
"You know that I do mind," said Gwendolen, angrily starting up. "I shall not see him."
She showed the intention to dart away to the door. Grandcourt was before her, with his back toward it. He was prepared for her anger, and showed none in return, saying with the same sort of remonstrant tone that he might have used about an objection to dining out,
"It's no use making a fuss. There are plenty of brutes in the world that one has to talk to. People with any savoir vivre don't make a fuss about such things. Some business must be done. You can't expect agreeable people to do it. If I employ Lush, the proper thing for you is to take it as a matter of course, not to make a fuss about it, not to toss your head and bite your lips about people of that sort."
The drawling and the pauses with which this speech was uttered gave time for crowding reflections in Gwendolen, quelling her resistance. What was there to be told her about property? This word had certain dominant associations for her, first with her mother, then with Mrs. Glasher and her children. What would be the use if she refused to see Lush? Could she ask Grandcourt to tell her himself? That might be intolerable, even if he consented, which it was certain he would not, if he had made up his mind to the contrary. The humiliation of standing an obvious prisoner, with her husband barring the door, was not to be borne any longer, and she turned away to lean against a cabinet, while Grandcourt again moved toward her.
"I have arranged for Lush to come up now while I am out," he said, after a long organ stop, during which Gwendolen made no sign. "Shall I tell him he may come?"
Yet another pause before she could say, "Yes." Her face turned obliquely and her eyes cast down.
"I shall come back in time to ride, if you like to get ready," said Grandcourt. No answer. "She is in a desperate rage," thought he.
But the rage was silent, and therefore not disagreeable to him. It followed that he turned her chin and kissed her, while she still kept her eyelids down, and she did not move them until he was on the other side of the door. What was she to do? Search where she would in her consciousness, she found no plea to justify a plaint. Any romantic illusion she had had in marrying this man had turned on her power of using him as she liked. He was using her as he liked. She sat awaiting the announcement of Lush as a sort of searing operation that she had to go through. The facts that galled her gathered a burning power when she thought of their lying in his mind. It was all a part of that new gambling in which the losing was not simply a minus, but a terrible plus that had never entered into her reckoning. Lush was neither quite pleased nor quite displeased with his task. Grandcourt had said to him by way of conclusion, "Don't make yourself more disagreeable than nature obliges you." "That depends," thought Lush. But he said, "I will write a brief abstract for Mrs. Grandcourt to read." He did not suggest that he should make the whole communication in writing, which was a proof that the interview did not wholly displease him. Some provision was being made for himself in the will, and he had no reason to be in a bad humor, even if a bad humor had been common with him. He was perfectly convinced that he had penetrated all the secrets of the situation, but he had no diabolical delight in it. He had only the small movements of gratified self-loving resentment in discerning that this marriage had fulfilled his own foresight in not being as satisfactory as the supercilious young lady had expected it to be, and as Grandcourt wished to feign that it was. He had no persistent spite, much stronger than what gives the seasoning of ordinary scandal to those who repeat it and exaggerate it by their conjectures. With no active compassion or goodwill, he had just as little active malevolence, being chiefly occupied in liking his particular pleasures, and not disliking anything but what hindered those pleasures, anything else ranking with the last murder and the last opéra bouffe under the head of things to talk about. Nevertheless, he was not indifferent to the prospect of being treated uncivilly by a beautiful woman, or to the counterbalancing fact that his present commission put into his hands an official power of humiliating her. He did not mean to use it needlessly, but there are some persons so gifted in relation to us that their "how do you do" seems charged with offense. By the time that Mr. Lush was announced, Gwendolen had braced herself to a bitter resolve that he should not witness the slightest betrayal of her feeling, whatever he might have to tell. She invited him to sit down with stately quietude. After all, what was this man to her? He was not in the least like her husband. Her power of hating a coarse, familiar-mannered man with clumsy hands was now relaxed by the intensity with which she hated his contrast. He held a small paper folded in his hand while he spoke. "I need hardly say that I should not have presented myself if Mr. Grandcourt had not expressed a strong wish to that effect, as no doubt he has mentioned to you." From some voices that speech might have sounded entirely reverential and even timidly apologetic. Lush had no intention to the contrary, but to Gwendolen's ear his words had as much insolence in them as his prominent eyes, and the pronoun "you" was too familiar. He ought to have addressed the folding screen and spoken of her as Mrs. Grandcourt. She gave the smallest sign of a bow, and Lush went on, with a little awkwardness, getting entangled in what is elegantly called tautology. "My having been in Mr. Grandcourt's confidence for 15 years or more, since he was a youth, in fact, of course gives me a particular position. He can speak to me of affairs that he could not mention to any one else, and in fact, he could not have employed any one else in this affair. I have accepted the task out of friendship for him, which is my apology for accepting the task, if you would have preferred some one else." He paused, but she made no sign, and Lush, to give himself a countenance in an apology which met no acceptance, opened the folded paper and looked at it vaguely before he began to speak again. "This paper contains some information about Mr. Grandcourt's will, an abstract of a part he wished you to know, if you'll be good enough to cast your eyes over it. But there is something I had to say by way of introduction, which I hope you'll pardon me for, if it's not quite agreeable." Lush found that he was behaving better than he had expected, and had no idea how insulting he made himself with his "not quite agreeable." "Say what you have to say without apologizing, please," said Gwendolen, with the air she might have bestowed on a dog-stealer come to claim a reward for finding the dog he had stolen. "I have only to remind you of something that occurred before your engagement to Mr. Grandcourt," said Lush, not without the rise of some willing insolence in exchange for her scorn. "You met a lady in Cardell Chase, if you remember, who spoke to you of her position with regard to Mr. Grandcourt. She had children with her, one a very fine boy." Gwendolen's lips were almost as pale as her cheeks. Her passion had no weapons. Words were no better than chips. This man's speech was like a sharp knife-edge drawn across her skin, but even her indignation at the employment of Lush was getting merged in a crowd of other feelings, dim and alarming as a crowd of ghosts. "Mr. Grandcourt was aware that you were acquainted with this unfortunate affair beforehand, and he thinks it only right that his position and intention should be made quite clear to you. It is an affair of property and prospects, and if there were any objection you had to make, if you would mention it to me,
It is a subject which, of course, he would rather not speak about himself, if you would be good enough just to read this." With the last words, Lush rose and presented the paper to her. When Gwendolen resolved that she would betray no feeling in the presence of this man, she had not prepared herself to hear that her husband knew the silent consciousness, the silently accepted terms on which she had married him. She dared not raise her hand to take the paper, lest it should visibly tremble. For a moment Lush stood holding it toward her, and she felt his gaze on her as ignominy, before she could say even with low-toned haughtiness, "Lay it on the table, and go into the next room, please." Lush obeyed, thinking as he took an easy chair in the back drawing-room, "My lady winces considerably. She didn't know what would be the charge for that superfine article, Henley Grandcourt." But it seemed to him that a penniless girl had done better than she had any right to expect, and that she had been uncommonly knowing for her years and opportunities. Her words to Lydia meant nothing, and her running away had probably been part of her adroitness. It had turned out a masterstroke. Meanwhile, Gwendolen was rallying her nerves to the reading of the paper. She must read it. Her whole being, pride, longing for rebellion, dreams of freedom, remorseful conscience, dread of fresh visitation, all made one need to know what the paper contained. But at first it was not easy to take in the meaning of the words. When she had succeeded, she found that in the case of there being no son as issue of her marriage, Grandcourt had made the small Henley his heir. That was all she cared to extract from the paper with any distinctness. The other statement, as to what provision would be made for her in the same case, she hurried over, getting only a confused perception of thousands and Gadsmere. It was enough. She could dismiss the man in the next room with the defiant energy which had revived in her at the idea that this question of property and inheritance was meant as a finish to her humiliations and her thraldom. She thrust the paper between the leaves of her book, which she took in her hand, and walked with her stateliest air into the next room, where Lush immediately arose, awaiting her approach. When she was 4 yards from him, it was hardly an instant that she paused to say, in a high tone, while she swept him with her eyelashes, "Tell Mr. Grandcourt that his arrangements are just what I desired." Passing on without haste, and leaving Lush time to mingle some admiration of her graceful back with that half-amused sense of her spirit and impertinence which he expressed by raising his eyebrows and just thrusting his tongue between his teeth. He really did not want her to be worse punished, and he was glad to think that it was time to go and lunch at the club, where he meant to have a lobster salad. What did Gwendolen look forward to? When her husband returned, he found her equipped in her riding dress, ready to ride out with him. She was not again going to be hysterical, or taken to her bed and say she was ill. That was the implicit resolve adjusting her muscles before she could have framed it in words as she walked out of the room, leaving Lush behind her. She was going to act in the spirit of her message, and not to give herself time to reflect. She rang the bell for her maid, and went with the usual care through her change of toilette. Doubtless her husband had meant to produce a great effect on her. By and by, perhaps she would let him see an effect the very opposite of what he intended, but at present all that she could show was a defiant satisfaction in what had been presumed to be disagreeable. It came as an instinct rather than a thought that to show any sign which could be interpreted as jealousy, when she had just been insultingly reminded that the conditions were what she had accepted with her eyes open, would be the worst self-humiliation. She said to herself that she had not time today to be clear about her future actions. All she could be clear about was that she would match her husband in ignoring any ground for excitement. She not only rode, but went out with him to dine, contributing nothing to alter their mutual manner, which was never that of rapid interchange in discourse. And curiously enough, she rejected a handkerchief on which her maid had by mistake put the wrong scent, a scent that Grandcourt had once objected to. Gwendolen would not have liked to be an object of disgust to this husband whom she hated. She liked all disgust to be on her side.